This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. For this edition of the Midweek Podcast, we're going to take you back to 2017 to a recording I made when I travelled to the Highlands to meet a guy with a really strange mixture of talents.
I am not going to pretend to be an expert in hip-hop. I know it's a music form and that it originated in New York, but to be frank, that's me kind of tapped out. Crofting I know a wee bit more about. It was once a very common way of life, right the way across Scotland, not just on the west coast. And it involved either making a living off the land or making a partial living off the land. But tying those two things together, hip-hop and crofting, might seem like strange bedfellows, but for Gregor Lowry, they are inextricably linked. And for the next 30 minutes, we're going to be hearing how Gregor goes about juggling a life as a touring musician, writer, crofter and scholar from his croft in Ballyhoolish, all the while trying to keep alive the language and the culture he grew up in.
Grounded, my roots like a tree, I sit still upon the rocks and move this energy in me because I'm founded in this land. I take my stand with my brothers and sisters hand in hand with the command of a language that's older than history. From Amoba to Egypt, I unlock the ancient history with solid foundations. Indeed, I project that I connect and interject for the architect.
So here we are, the Sheon Valley. In Ballyhoo, North Ballyhoolish. This is kind of the end of the road, really. This was where the Sheon Valley, the Old Town Road, met up here and ended just at the ruins of the old houses just round the corner there. And there were several families who lived here at one time. Actually, now it's just myself and this wonderful herd of hairy Highlanders that you see before you.
As we came down the steps from your living quarters, we didn't kick him out of the way, but, you know, certainly, thankfully, she cooperated. She did it of her own accord. They're not shy.
They're definitely not shy. They're used to people being around, and as you can see, there's no fence between the house and the cows at the moment. That's something that I'm going to have to change. I'm out feeding them by hand every day in the winter. So, you know, they get very used to you being around. Doesn't mean you don't have to watch out for the horns or the kick, even for that matter.
Most of them are black. You've got two red ones. Why?
Well, I have one red one. I had planned on having it completely a black herd because that is the original. In fact, the old drovers, as Martin notes in his book, wouldn't actually go near a beast unless it was black. I don't know whether that's because they thought they were hard there or whether, you know, it was just tradition. The poor red ones, they managed to make it onto the croft anyway. They made it through. The red jeans made it through. And I'm not going to get rid of them just because they're red, you know.
Happened to be the wrong colour. Here we go. That's the bull is determined to make his presence felt. Right up against the back of that hire car of mine, which is less than ideal.
Well, you're saying a bull, but that's actually a large, quite old bullock who will be getting sold off
Seriously?
Very soon. I should say that's low in case he hears us. I keep them for 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Highland beef is slow maturing.
Uh-huh.
And I finish them myself, so he'll be getting taken away and meeting his grim end pretty soon, unfortunately for him.
And we're giving his life in a good cause, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a musician and a poet and a scholar. How does it work with the croft? Because you can't always be here.
I certainly can't be here. I'm very, very fortunate to have a couple of good friends in the community here who look after the cows for me when I'm away and kind of keep an eye on the place for me when I'm away. Without them, actually, I wouldn't be able to keep the place going. My parents are very helpful as well. You know, they come and man the helm for me, so to speak, when I'm away playing too. So, fortunately, I've just got a good bunch of people around about me to help me keep the place going.
Is there a... I don't know if this is a pretentious question. Is there a deeper significance to having a croft?
Absolutely. And it's not a pretentious question at all. It's a very poignant question, particularly my own mission and my own motivation for keeping these animals here and for working this land as a croft. As most people will know, the Gaels, the indigenous people of this area, didn't have the best time of it, really, over the past several centuries. And a lot of us were cleared away from our land and forcibly removed, evicted, sent over in leaky ships over to the colonies to have a better life, and or even just actually forcibly removed. And a lot of the land for that reason was left empty. Like you see here, this land hasn't been worked properly for generations. And that's actually the reason behind it, is the social and economic circumstances that removed the people from the land. And I consider myself a native of this place. My family come from around here. I'm a Gaelic speaker. I've got strong connections with the Gaeltacht community around here. And in the process of working this as a croft and doing what I'm doing here, I'm reclaiming my culture and I'm reclaiming what I consider to belong to me.
Sy'n y derg ag y hor, sy'n y cor, sy'n y cor, neu cor eich i'n sorch. Yn cwni y grin, nes yr un hi grwt dŵras, ys ffeim ar y nŵl, bod y rŵs yn gystwras. Fy hwn ydy'n i wer hyd neu deud yn gytwras.
I'm not a Gaelic speaker, but I've worked with lots of Gaels. And you sound slightly different to me. Is there a mainland variant of Gaelic?
I do speak the mainland dialect of Gaelic, and actually more particularly than that, I speak Balachulish Gaelic. I was very fortunate to be exposed to actually the last speakers, unfortunately, of my dialect of Gaelic. And I spent a lot of time around them recording and noting down all the intricacies of the local dialect. And not just the language, but also the songs, the stories, the folklore, and all sorts of information about different families and different people who, most of whom have actually left the area now. The language started to really falter after the Second World War. There was a lot of damage already done by then, of course, through the stance that the education system took towards Gaelic and other institutions in the country took towards Gaelic. But actually, what put the nail in the coffin, so to speak, was that last bout of immigration that took place after the Second World War. Most of those people would have been emigrating to, you know, the Central Belt, to Glasgow, to other parts of the country where they could find employment, because of course the main employment around here, my own family found employment in the industry, was slate. My family aren't actually from this side of the loch, North Balachulish. They're from what we call Warach, which is South Balachulish, and for generations they worked the slate quarry there. And of course when the slate quarry closed down, the area saw massive decline, really. It closed down shortly after the Second World War, in around the early 1920s, actually. And despite several attempts to start it up again and get the slate industry going again in Balachulish, it never took off. And of course, you know, that caused a lot of people to leave the area and seek employment elsewhere.
I know this is politically very sensitive, but my late mother-in-law, her family were from Haboston Lewis. And Chris didn't speak Gaelic. She could understand it. And she would listen to it on the radio, you know, Radio and Gael and things. They weren't discouraged from speaking it for political reasons. They were discouraged from speaking it because they thought it would hold them back. And it may be all the things you've talked about, you know, all the clearances and everything else in the long, long history. Gaelic, rightly or wrongly, by people who spoke it, began to be perceived as the language of the losers.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is absolutely true. And this is actually a lot of what my studies are to do with. I'm currently writing a PhD Well, when I eventually get time to sit down and write it.
When you give yourself time.
When I give myself time, exactly. What I'm actually concentrating on at the moment, in the chapter that I'm writing at the moment, is this idea of the internalisation that your culture isn't good enough, that your language isn't good enough. This is not something that people thought naturally because, mm-hmm. of course, we spoke our own language and we naturally were comfortable within our own language and within our own skin for mm-hmm. hundreds and thousands of years. This only came about post-Culloden, really, post-colonisation, you know. I mean, we can go back to 1607, to the Statutes of Iona, King James VI and I insisting that anyone of any kind of material possession within the Highlands, clan chiefs and their taxmen, had to be educated in English, in the Lowlands mm-hmm. or in England. And, of course, this really kind of transformed the way in which we saw ourselves. All of a sudden, people weren't calling themselves Dal Machal, and you know, Donald MacDonald. They were right. calling themselves, you know, the yeah. English version of this, their name, you know, Machunich became Mackenzie, etc., etc., you know. So we got this dual identity forming at that time whereby people had, they aspired, everything that was great and good and enterprising was in the English, everything to do with trade and everything to do with even the kind of scholarly things that were going on at the time. And that kind of continued all the way through, even till nowadays, that people still have internalised that idea that their culture is somehow inferior. And I think it's actually only my generation now who are able to stand back and look at what's actually happened over the past several hundred years and say, well, wait a minute, no, our culture is not inferior, you know, it's just a different type of culture. It's not it didn't develop as a culture and a language of commerce and expansion the way that English and the kind of English British culture did.
Han glernen big boy and gartoch mogu Farn dŵr mis y marwch smor ewrwch Ewns yn gwynir ych o sir ysbyn yr yn tyw Mae'r anwys ac yn wondws yn smewrwch
In that term, I would argue that Gaelic is a describing culture, or a describing language. It is a fraternal language. You are part and parcel of what is around you. So as a Gaelic speaker, what do you get from this landscape that I, as a non-Gaelic speaker, don't?
Well, when I look around me, I don't see a hill. Mm-hmm. I see Ún a Chanhíon Vór. I see Chreig Gú. I see Chreig Vór. I see Tomín. I see Chreig Vrech. I see na Tomán an Dua. I see, you know, and all of these names that I just mentioned to you, they all have stories attached mm-hmm. to them. They all have meaning behind them. And they all describe the connection between the people who have lived here for hundreds of years and the land, and not just between the people that have lived here and the land, but also between all the other forms of life that are here in the land as well. Mm-hmm. And the Gaelic language has a very, very strong connection, like other indigenous cultures throughout the world do, with just heard a bird singing in the background there.
Well,
that's
done.
That's a good example. You know, we have these really elaborate ways of vocalising birdsong. These are things that were taught to children from a young age. And in fact, Alistair Machi Levy, Alexander Carmichael from Lismore, he noted that in his time he heard children imitating the birdsong uh-huh. so closely that the birds would come to them.
Fona ben ych y ge ag y si iawn Han y hyn yn sn y ceil tyn y sboi chyd yn tyw Hewn yn glewn yn mogyw tywoch liwn
You know, there is a richness and a depth there, you know, and I wish I was part of it. I genuinely do wish I was part of it, but is it too late to restore that shining kingdom?
Well, I don't think any kind of revival should ever attempt to recreate what was there before, because it's not achievable. But what a revival movement can do is engage people in the culture and try to make it relevant to their lives and who they are. You know, it's very easy to become bitter and say, oh, the language is dead, and, you know, just turn your back on it, even as a Gael. But I think that the way forward, actually, is to try and explain to people why Gaelic is still relevant, why Gaelic still has a place in our culture here in Scotland, And, you know, there has been a certain amount of money that's been put into the media and education and various other avenues, but I think we have to go a lot further than that and look at the way that the language is actually a part of all our identities here in Scotland. It's not just a language, it's a whole philosophy and a way of thinking and a way of seeing yourself within history and within the social demographics of modern Scotland even. Har en sag, en dump min arn, en skin dump min sundi. En fotdag med brån, så fag en machur. Har en rus en magav, så hauer machur. En smiga rus en sau, så fech en magur. Hun med strir, jo gedanner, eller kins, jeg skal dave, man tjener en gærs, der snart fag, ikke jeres tog, vi det gav. Du er ikke kav, men sit dave, ikke det vav, og jeg fuger en gav, og det gav. So, this here is the ruins of the old croft houses. The actual date in which the houses were built I cannot give you, because there aren't really any old people here in North Ballachulish who have that information left, unfortunately. But what I can tell you is that this house here was still occupied in the earlier part of the 20th century by a Campbell before the land was sold off to go along with the Tainroa. Tainroa is the Gaelic for the Lochleven Hotel. This was all part of the one kind of parcel, if you like, of land. I would imagine that this place here where we're standing has been, there's been some kind of domicile here for...
Look, somebody's been leaving money.
Oh, that was left out in Halloween for the fairies, along with milk as well, actually. That's
Who
one
left
of the,
it out?
Myself and some of my friends.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, like, tongue in cheek?
Well, it's a thing that I like to do is on Samhain. And Belton, I like to get a wee fire going and just keep the old tradition alive. Of course, at Belton, there were two fires lit. What happened in Belton is the cows would be let out onto the common grazings. This is the common grazings here. So we didn't actually do it this year, but we done it last year. We got the two fires lit and drove the cows in between the two fires with the piper marching out in front and took them out onto the hill that way, you know.
Is that a sort of purification ceremony?
Absolutely, yes. It's to keep away evil spirits and to keep away, you know, any the drachul or any of these kind of curses that could bring bad luck upon your herd. That was great fun, at bringing that tradition back alive after maybe before Culloden, since that was done.
This is fascinating, these ruins, because the walls are probably about 2 feet thick. They're very well made. It's ashlar work, but again, it's a sort of local slate that's here. Not all of it is absolutely flat. It's a laminar stone, but it's not all flat. Nicely done.
Thank you very much. That bit there is the bit that we've done ourselves.
Oh, that's very good. That's very good. But I mean, basically, you're looking at, what, 17 yards, some metres?
About that, yeah.
But they're to the end of it. So that side probably slightly lower is for the animals. This side is the living quarters. You've got essentially almost like a raised garden up behind this house.
Yes, and you can
slightly
see
walled.
What we call in Gaelic a staran there as well. You know, the wee kind of path behind as well, made out of slate. I just discovered this actually fairly recently. That was quite well buried, you know.
Yeah.
But it's well constructed, and you can see how thick the walls. That's all our own work there, actually, building it exactly the way it would have, not exactly the way it would have been, but as close as we can, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, what makes this house not unique but unusual for this area are these big lechken, the flagstones, on the floor there. You know that a stone floor in the Highlands of old meant that you were quite a distinguished person, and. That's why I'm convinced there's still a few wee bits of information that I can draw upon to prove my theory or not, but I'm pretty much 99% convinced that at one time part of this building that's still standing, at least in these stones and where we are right now, was the house of Dochamor Machinich, who was the head of the local clan here. The local clan to this land was Quanchinich Valechewish or Natuwish, which in the colonizers' language I'll be heavy, is the Mackenzies of North Ballachulish.
Okay.
There's actually stories that have came down to us about Dunchamore. I'm saying it in Gaelic. That means Big Duncan. He was present at the Battle of Prestonpans. He was involved in a bit of a skirmish with a redcoat trooper who had fallen off his horse, and there were several other Jacobite soldiers round about this guy, you know, winding him up. And Dulchamor stood up and he said, "Hear Curram na Fain," the guy. That's how we say, give him the chance, give him a fair play. So he was given the chance of the Fianna against Dulchamor, and Dulchamor defeated him in a duel. And just as Dulchamor was finishing off, he heard a cry coming from his commander that there was another trooper coming his way. He was only a few feet away coming towards him and his horse. So Dulchamor had to think very, very quickly. Jumped up onto a dike behind him, and just as the trooper was passing him, pulled out his sword, jumped up off of the dike and cracked the trooper right in the helmet. Mm-hmm. The sword went right through the top of his helmet all the way down to his chin. So obviously this was an amazing feat, you know, defeating these two soldiers. So that night the Jacobite officers were all gathered together, Murray and the Prince himself, and they were all talking about who had distinguished themselves on the battlefield that day. And of course MacDonald of Kinlochmoider was talking about his men who had distinguished themselves, and you know, various other commanders were talking about the various great warriors of their regiments. And Lochiel mentioned Dulchamor and this great feat of jumping off of the dike and, you know, the sword going right through the helmet. And without further ado, he was ordered to present himself before them. He did that, and he was taken there, and the commander said, "Oh, well, can you put your sword on the table?" On the sword was an indent about that size from where it had gone through the helmet. The commander said, "Well, I'll give you what you can lay over the blade of the sword of guineas for your sword." Dulchamor said, no, I'm not going to sell my sword. I'm taking it back home with me. You know, I want to keep it, you know." So anyway, as the campaign went on and the Jacobite army pressed forward to Derby, Dulchamor actually came back to Ballachulish. Some of Argyll's troops caught up with him in Bridge of Orkey, and he was taken to Inveraray and put in a cell there. Anyway, the Duke said to him he would be lenient and actually, you know, let him go back to Ballachulish if he would give him this sword. So he gave him the sword, and the sword is actually in Inveraray Castle to this day. Okay. And you can see the notch, and it measures exactly with the kind of helmet that the Hanoverian army would have worn at the time.
As a culture, we tend to see things in terms of, that was the past, our forefathers, this is now, you know, the future, you know, these will be the people that come along after us. There are cultures in the world, however, who mix all three up, who just say, no, it's all three, they're parallel lines, three parallel lines running simultaneously. So every action they take, they look backwards at what their forebearers might have thought about it, or they look forward to think what the implications might be for oncoming generations, which I think is a fantastic mindset.
I think John Lauren Campbell, the great Gaelic scholar, once said that most of the modern European people have a horizontal way of thinking, whereas the Gael has a vertical way of thinking. Uh-huh. You know, this was his way of describing it.
Yeah. But, you know, if there is such a thing as the veil between, you know, present and past, it's a very, very thin veil in your case. It's obviously a very real world for you.
Oh, very, very much so. And a lot of that actually has to do with my upbringing and the way in which tradition was transmitted to me through the piping side of things. I was very, very aware from a young age of my ancestors who had distinguished themselves in the piping world here in Ballachulish. And the more I got into that at a young age, it kind of became like an addiction. I had to know more about my ancestors, to the stage where it became pretty much everything I do, every action that I take to this day is basically founded upon this connection between me and my ancestors. And the world, the way I see it, is very much not just through my own eyes, but through their eyes in a sense as well, if you can get where I'm coming from.
When did you start writing Gaelic poetry, and what's your poetry about?
I started writing Gaelic poetry in my early 20s. When I first started writing Gaelic poetry, I was kind of emulating the poets that I was interested in reading. Donal Roaf Ashlig, Donal MacIntyre from South Uist, and the other South Uist poets, Dalian Gulnachy. And these are poets that I was exposed to because I was living in South Uist at the time. I always had a real interest in the poets from around here, but until I undertook the work of unearthing that poetry, maybe about 7 years ago or whatever, I hadn't actually been exposed to much of that, you know, because it was kind of lying in various books and archives, etc. I'd yet to discover that. So at that time, my main influences were actually poets from the Hebrides. The subject matter of my poetry has always been political. I think it's difficult to be an active language activist or revivalist, or whatever you want to call it, without being political, without being interested in social justice, without being interested in the way in which the wrongs of the past affect us now to this day, and particularly with what I was talking about this idea of internalising the inferiority complex. This has always been something that I've been really interested in because I've seen it all over the country amongst my own people, amongst my own, even, you know, close friends. That actually has a big place in my poetry. I like to talk also about the role that the Highlanders played in the building of the British Empire and in, you know, in the First World War and all that kind of thing. And I ask the questions, well, what did we actually get out of that?
I'm using this phrase advisedly because, I mean, I can remember about 15, 20 years ago, somebody put forward a motion that Gaelic be reclassified as an Aboriginal culture. And I think, to be honest, I think it was mischievous. And because they saw a possibility of even more money coming. They thought, very good idea. But one of the I thought it was strange in a way, because one of the characteristic of just about, well, I can't think of an exception, truth to be told, of every Aboriginal culture I can think of, is they are dying out. They are in decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's quite right that we consider Gaelic an Aboriginal culture. I think the actual culture of the Gael, rather than just the language and the culture together go hand in hand. Our beliefs here, a lot of people don't actually know quite how deep our beliefs went here in the Highlands, even if they're not, if these beliefs aren't part of our daily practice now. For example, seals themselves actually weren't hunted here in Ballachulish in particular because they were considered to carry on the spirits of people who had passed. And there's actually songs relating to that as well, which are tied into the what we call Kel Mór, the big music of the Highland bagpipe. So I think with everything that I'm doing with Gaelic culture and everything I'm doing with my music and everything I'm doing here with the Croft, I'm trying to connect. You asked about the content of my poetry as well, and I gave you the idea maybe the political side of it, but this aspect of it as well about the indigenuity to the land and these beliefs that we have and to do with the animals, etc. This is a massive kind of door that we've opened here as far as it isn't just a language. You know, it's not just a culture, you know, there's so much depth to it. So here with the Croft, my eventual aim is to develop a centre where people can come and learn the language, learn the music and the history, etc. But not only learn these things, but also learn about these deeper aspects of the culture, these aspects of the culture which aren't really well known, which haven't really been explored and haven't really been exposed to a wider audience, so to speak, and to show people that this is the indigenous culture of this area, and this is our beliefs, and this is how we lived with the land since time immemorial. So I'm hoping that this can really be a space where people can come, connect with the history, go up to these old ruins, and learn about the people that lived in them, see the way that the houses were built, see the way that people were such a part of the landscape, and how the language and the culture and the songs and the music were all such a part of the landscape, and just reconnect with that, you know?
Tough question. In 30, 40 years' time, when this is up and running, you know, and you're getting to retirement stage and what have you, and you're looking back at a life well lived, are you going to be looking at something here that is part of a living, continuing, breathing tradition, or is it going to be a museum piece?
The idea is that this will not be a museum piece. This is going to be a living, breathing, working place. It's not just an exhibition. It's not just something for people. And maybe I actually worded it wrong there in my description of what I foresee this place being, this space becoming. My dream, if you like, is to see the place as a living, breathing place where people can come and interact with a living culture, with a thriving culture, with a space where the language and the culture can be spoken and expressed safely and without being smothered, if you like, by, you know, the all-powerful, all-encompassing, massive, global tongue, which is English.
My thanks to Gregor Lowry for speaking to me there, poet, piper, music maker, scholar and crofter.